kid stuff? Well, maybe not entirely. Adults have their toys, too. But for today, we'll stick to children and look at their toys in the context of the history of childhood in America. To do that, we welcome to Talking History, historian Fred Nielsen.
Countless historians have focused on women, Abraham Lincoln, and the American combat soldier. Today's guest has instead focused on Barbie, Lincoln Logs, and G.I. Joe. He is Gary Cross, professor of history at Penn State University, and the author of Kids Stuff, Toys and the Changing World of American Childhood. Toys, he suggests, are not just playthings for children, they are also reflections of American society, its family life, gender roles, consumerism, and popular culture. In ways both profound and occasionally disconcerting, toys really are us. Gary Cross, welcome.
Well, thank you.
One of your themes in Kids Stuff is that toys have told the young what adults valued and expected of them. These messages, like the toys themselves, have changed over the years, of course. If you would, take us back to the early part of the 20th century. What toys were boys and girls playing with?
Well, as you can imagine, because science, technology, transportation were exciting subjects for so many people, particularly for boys, the toys often revolved around these issues. For example, electric trains or construction toys like erector sets, and even toys that that taught boys the elements of science, like the famous chemistry set. These were all very popular at that time.
And what were girls playing with?
Well, girls, of course, were playing with toys that began to reflect a growing concern on the part of parents that girls learn how to nurture children. They were very different from boys' toys. In fact, they got more sharply different in the early 20th century. There were a lot of baby toys that became quite prominent, toys that looked like babies and sometimes did things like babies do, if you know what I mean. And also there were dolls that really taught little girls how to care about their peers. They were what I call companion dolls. They were dolls that looked like little girls, and as girls played with them, they were expected to act like little girls in their play. And of course, girls gradually outgrew these dolls, but in terms of contemporary times, girls played with dolls for until quite a mature age, perhaps as old as 14.
There are times, certainly, when one of the purposes of having a doll is not even to play with it as much as to clothe it. Is that right?
Well, that's right. That's a good point. And of course, this had been around for some years. In the 19th century, it was common for a little girl to get what was called a sewing doll, where she would learn how to sew with it. By the 20th century, the clothes were more often made, and instead the girl was expected to dress it. And of course, a modification of this was the paper doll. So much of the girl's doll play was about fashion and about current fashion.
What were adults trying to tell children when they bought them the erector sets, the chemistry sets, the dolls that you described?
Well, they were trying to tell them what it was going to be like when they grew up. It was a way of giving children in miniature the tools of adults, in a way to introduce them to the roles of adults. And of course, at the beginning of the 20th century, those roles were very segmented for boys and for girls, for men and for women.
Connected to that is also the fact that the advertising, such as it was at the time, was often directed more toward the parents than the child. Is that right?
That's right, because, of course, children had very little money, and whenever they and of course it was assumed that it was parental choice that determined what toy would be given to the child.
In fact, even some of the ads encouraged the parents to play with the child. The Lionel train was to be played with by the father and the son.
Right. Well, this was an important matter in the early 20th century. It became obvious to so many people interested in families that fathers no longer had any really direct role in their children's lives. They didn't teach their sons about work or often the kinds of skills it would take to become a man. And so one of the ways that the child care experts and then, of course, the toy companies felt to bring fathers back into contact, particularly with their boys, was through play, and of course the electric train came along just in time for that.
You mentioned that children didn't have a lot of money back in 1900. I guess that's changed. The title of one of your recent books is an all-consuming society, which describes the 20th century.
Right.
And consumerism is certainly a theme throughout your book, Kids Stuff. How is the history of toys tied to the history of rising affluence and consumerism in America in the 20th century?
Well, of course, what happens at the beginning of the 20th century is there emerges a whole lot of new consumer products, baked beans and chewing gum and soda in bottles and that sort of thing, as well as cars that change every year. And the toys, in many ways, reflected this. There were a lot more toys, toys that changed much more frequently, just as consumer goods, and toys that that really were beginning to become tied to the fantasy world of celebrities and of movies and comic strip figures. And so the consumer culture, which emerges in the early 20th century, was really very much reflected in the new toy culture, so to speak.
Obviously, television played a huge role in the transformation of the advertising of toys, especially. That would have occurred in the 1950s and after. How did TV change the American toy business?
Well, it changed it basically by giving advertisers a way of reaching children directly. What begins to happen, really, with both the Hasbro and Mattel, the two major toy companies of today, is that these two toy companies learned in the 1950s how to advertise directly to children on children's programs. And we think of something like the Mickey Mouse Clubs, for those of a certain age. The Mickey Mouse Club of 1955 was heavily drenched with advertisements for Mattel products, eventually Barbie, but also an awful lot of toy pistols and cap guns and the like. So the main thing is that toys began to become a part of a child's fantasy world that parents didn't necessarily know about because they didn't, and they very infrequently watched children's television programs where the advertisements were placed.
And this would be a big transformation from, say, half a century ago when the ads...
Yeah, so it is probably the most important thing that happens with toys, and I would argue perhaps even with children's culture, is that it becomes, both really become separate from the world of adults.
And what begins with the Mattel ads on the Mickey Mouse Club in the 1950s and other TV ads becomes an entirely different beast by the 1980s and 90s. You talk about the PLCs, the program length commercials. Mm-hmm. Could you describe those for us, please?
Right. What happens really is that that by the late 70s, certainly into the 80s, what happens is this gradual trend toward a toy that is directed specifically to children, that trend has matured. And what happens is that in the 1950s, toy companies discover that they can actually produce a toy and create a market for it through a cartoon feature, the so-called program-length commercial. That's why they're called that. And so you have a series of toys like He-Man and Masters of the Universe and a number of others, Transformers and so forth, that are promoted through cartoons. In a way, the cartoons become really an advertisement for the toys.
Is there a most absurd toy in the 20th century?
Yeah, we were talking about that. One of the most absurd is the so-called Dino Riders. And the reason why these are so strange is because the idea of the Dino Rider, it came in the mid-80s, was to give little boys dinosaurs, which are very popular with 5-, 6-, 7-year-old boys, and to make them accurate using a scientist to affirm their accuracy, but to place these dinosaurs in a space age context where the dinosaurs are ridden by spacemen in intergalactic warfare, and it's what makes it absurd, I suppose, is this strange combination of 65 million years ago with the distant future, giving boys this kind of fantasy world that is completely divorced from reality.
And that becomes, of course, one of the main themes of your book, Kid Stuff, that toys are, by the late 20th century, certainly increasingly divorced from reality. As you say several times, they exist in a fantasy world detached from the actual past of the parents and the expected future of the children. How did that come to pass?
Well, I think one of the reasons is because the toy that adults had formerly given children, toys that anticipated the future, or perhaps were nostalgic about the adult's past, like electric trains, for example, that were still quite popular in the 1950s and early 60s, these kinds of toys became more or less irrelevant because parents really no longer, by the 70s and 80s, no longer had this sense of what the child's future would be, and they certainly didn't think it would have anything to do with electric trains, nor did the child. And so what has happened is that the kind of certainty that parents had in earlier days about what to give a child and what was appropriate for a child as miniatures of their future lives, well, that had disappeared. And in its place really has emerged a fantasy industry that has turned out to be really quite profitable, at least up until recently, for toy companies, producing ever-changing fads and fantasies for childhood play.
Undoubtedly, the most successful cinematic fantasy of the last generation is Star Wars. Everyone knows how successful it was as a series of movies, but you make the, for me, surprising point that from 1977 to 1983, licensed Star Wars toys actually sold more in dollars than did the movies.
Yes, well, that might seem surprising, but you have to realize just how many of these toys and licensed products they were. You could get them in toothbrushes and glasses and of course, lunch pails and clothes and beds, linen and all sorts of things. The Star Wars figures stories became very, very ubiquitous in children's lives. They were, boys at that time particularly, were really just drenched with it. And, going to the movie was just a one-shot deal, or maybe a 14-times deal for many kids. But it was really part of this modern phenomena of combining media like a movie or a TV show with toys and with all sorts of other licensed products to really kind of envelop the child in the story.
You mentioned that you began your research with, and this is your phrase, a sharply critical eye. I assume that's an eye toward the toy industry, but that you developed a more complex and balanced view of...
Yeah, well, of course, the first time you look at these things and you haven't seen toys for a long time, you think, well, where are the Tinker Toys and where are the Lincoln Logs? And you wonder what has been imposed upon our children. Or in my case, my child. And then after a while, you realize, as you did research into this, that a lot of the fantasy and the seeming frivolity, certainly the fad-based nature of these toys, is really much older than we might realize. We take something like a teddy bear. It was a fad in 1906, very much as were Furbies in the last year or so, or Cabbage Patch dolls in the mid-80s. So a lot of what seems to be new about toys, in a way, has been around for a while. It's just become more intense.
And certainly, while toys may have their problems, examples of consumerism run amok,
yeah.
One of the points that you make, I think, is that they are a small part of larger developments. The consumer developments of America in the 20th century, for example, encompass more than just the toy industry, after all.
Well, that's right. In my book, All Consuming Century, that you mentioned just at the outset, that just came out a few weeks ago, one of the points I make is that in the latter part of the 20th century, certainly from the 1980s on, a lot of consumer goods were really about dividing people, giving people access to their own special fantasy or play or identity worlds. And what we've done for children is simply the same thing that we've done for ourselves. If a boy has a Game Boy, well, what do we have? We have our personal computers. We have our own private Walkman or other kinds kinds of goods that we use, that we use really in a lot of ways to isolate ourselves, not only from each other, but from other generations and other people, even in our own families. So what has happened with children, I think, and when we look at toys, we can really see in some ways just simply the consumer culture, perhaps writ large.
And that's quite a change, of course, from where we began back around 1900, when the father was to play with his son. Now, instead of binding families together, the toys are examples of what drive us apart.
Well, it certainly doesn't facilitate communication between parents and children. And at the outset, I was interested in the way that toys allowed adults and children to reach one another, communicate with one another. And in a series of these sorts of interviews that I've done since the book came out, I realized that a lot of people really long for that and really wish the toys would return to some of that, and not just parents, but kids as well. I was quite shocked one day when my boy was about 7 and he asked me to teach him how to play marbles. And I was amazed he didn't know, but on the other hand, I was slightly gratified anyway that he chose to ask me, because what he was really saying is he wanted to find something in his world that could connect with mine. And I think that is something that maybe is missing now, and it's something that parents and children might think about in resolving. Maybe we can find in the way we play and we relate to each other ways of connecting, because I know a lot of us want it.
Well, thank you so much for visiting with us today, Professor Cross.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Gary Cross, author of Kid Stuff, Toys and the Changing World of American Childhood.